to recap a little bit. So we started to talk about the issue of Gid HaNasheh, the prohibition that we have to eat the sciatic nerve of the animal. And we saw that there are a couple of issues in the background. And first of all, how we relate to the mitzvah is its own question. If the mitzvah seems to have a different status than other mitzvahs in the Torah, both as far as its history and as far as the connection between the history and the mitzvah. So it's a mitzvah that is discussed in the narrative of the Torah in Parshas Vayishlach, where we find that Yaakov's injury from his encounter with the Malach leaves him with something to remember, and that for that reason, Al-Kain, so far, because of that, the Bnei Yisrael don't eat the Gid HaNasheh. And prompting many questions, as we tried to lay out a little bit yesterday, as to what is the connection between the two, and what's the Torah referring to when it says the Bnei Yaakov, the Bnei Yisrael specifically. Is this a prohibition that was relevant to his family with particular attention? Is this a mitzvah like any other mitzvah? And we saw the Rambam. The Rambam, in his commentary to the Mishnah, emphasizes, and it sounds like the Gemara is really saying this as well, that the fact that we observe Gid HaNasheh today is not because of Yaakov, but it's because Moshe Rabbeinu gave us the Torah at Har Sinai, conveyed the Torah to us at Har Sinai, and all the mitzvot that we observe are a function of that. Just to supplement that a little bit, to add some points we didn't really discuss yesterday, the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, I don't think I gave you that to look at, but he goes through the whole history of mitzvot, where he talks about how there were Sheva mitzvot Bnei Noach, and how they came through instruction to Adam, and then to Noach, and then ultimately Moshe fills in the rest of the Torah. So in between, he does say there that Yaakov added Meiser, and also Gid HaNasheh. So you have to take the two sources together, the Rambam and Perush Mishnayos and the Rambam and Mishnah Torah, as far as where Gid HaNasheh comes from as a mitzvah. And it seems, as Bachsam Sofer explains, that essentially it could be true that Yaakov had this as an enactment for his family, but that doesn't have the power of a tzivoy for us today. It has a mitzvah for us today because it was given at Har Sinai. So that still emphasizes for us the question of, okay, so then why did the Torah leave it in Parshas Vayishlach? What exactly is the intent of that? And it seems to connect the Talmud of the mitzvah to the mitzvah itself in a stronger than usual way. You know, one can draw a parallel that if you learn Hilchos Sukkah, so in Hilchos Sukkah you find that the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch have the language of Laman Yedu Dorotechem Ki Besukkos Hoshavti Es Bnei Yisrael. That in Parshas Emor, when the Torah tells us about the Moadim and it tells us about the mitzvah of Sukkah, so it contains that phrase that we should sit in the Sukkah on Sukkot because God placed us in Sukkos in the Midbar, and the whole discussion whether that means literal Sukkos or whether that means Anane HaKavod, but one way or another, that pasuk is quoted in the Torah, in the Shulchan Aruch, when it tells us about the mitzvah of Sukkah, and the Bach on the side of the page of the Torah raises the question, if the Torah is a halacha sefer, it's just telling you what to do. So why does it bring in there Laman Yedu Dorotechem in talking about the rules of the mitzvah? And he suggests that there is an added element here, more than other mitzvos, that in general, there's a lot to discuss about whether we say mitzvos trichos kavana, do we say mitzvos require intent or not, and usually we mean just intent to know that you're doing a mitzvah. But it could be in the context of Sukkah, there is a greater requirement that we also have an awareness of why we're doing it. And that's a part of halacha of Sukkot. So Hilchos Sukkot is So maybe there's something similar here that built into the din is the awareness of how this impacted Yaakov, or maybe how it didn't impact Yaakov, how Yaakov overcame. But it's a little bit of a harder fit, because it's one thing when you have a positive mitzvah. So then we could say, okay, you do this positive mitzvah and you have to also have this intent that this is what you are doing it for and this is what's in your mind. Here, if we're talking about an Avera, talking about something that we don't do, so it's harder to see where intent fits in, but it could fit in on the structural level, that why the mitzvah is the way it is, why the rules are the way they are, could reflect the theme of the mitzvah in a more powerful way. So some of the details, just to go through some of them together, some of the disputed details. So one question would be, so the initial situation where this took place was with a person, right, with Yaakov. So is there a concept of Gid Hanasha by people? Does Gid Hanasha only refer to animals? The Mishnah says Behema and Chaya, yes. Oaf, no, because Oaf doesn't have the same anatomy. So therefore, that's already interesting. It's not going to match closely enough. So what about as far as people are concerned? Is there an Isser Gid Hanasha by people? So you might say, well, why is he bringing this up? Well, my nafkamina, we don't really eat people that often. And if we do, we have other issues, right? So maybe this isn't the question that we really need to be talking about. And there's something a little strange going on here. Why is that even an issue? So yes, it is a theoretical issue at best. Do not try this at home. But it may still reflect some elements here. So the Rashba is quoted in a few places as maintaining that there is a concept of Gid Hanasha by people. And that, as is also pointed out in the later Svarim, that could be something that is L'shitaso. Because here, not to make you all the more uncomfortable, but the Rashba maintains that Lagabe cannibalism, Lagabe people, that we don't actually have an Isser. Now, to emphasize, do not try that at home. We're not recommending that. But there is a whole question in general, what exactly is the technical Isser of cannibalism? Again, highly discouraged. Again, not something that you should be engaging in. But whether it is something that the Torah specifically prohibits in the same category as chazer is an interesting discussion. Bottom line, don't do it. But there is a discussion if a person has to choose to save his life, so has a choice between Basar Adam and Basar Nevela, so what's worse? Now in practice, again, don't try this at home, and in practice you'd assume that I think there's a good case to be made that a Basar Nevela is definitely the better option if you are stuck with only those two options, but there's a whole lumdus behind it, which we could discuss. It's pretty chulin related, actually, but it's a little bit outside of the scope. The Sefer Dor Revi, which we've mentioned throughout the year, Dor Revi was written by Rav Moshe Shmuel Glasner, who was a great-grandson of the Chassam Sofer. It's a fascinating Sefer on chulin. So the Dor Revi has a often quoted thesis where he says that because it's so disgusting to the human sense of morality, and it's so against the shared ethic of the world, so that creates its own Isser, and that's enough reason. But be that as it may, the Rashba was among the Rishonim who didn't see a specific Isser, so that leaves him room to say, okay, so Gid Hanasha has space to have its own Isser here. And in the context of saying that, Mishnah Melech, and others quote the Rashba, he writes that specifically, because that's how the original Maista was. It wasn't about the Gid Hanasha of a person. So therefore, all the more so, it makes sense that the Isser should apply in that context specifically. Okay, so there are a few other applications where you find that the nature of the Isser correlates to the history, and maybe the application should either be limited or expanded based on that. There is a quote in the Crazy Uplacy. The Crazy Uplacy was Ravona Sinaitris, the tremendous Gaonim of the 1700s. And in his Sefer on Yeridea, in the Crazy Uplacy, he quotes an opinion that it shouldn't apply to female animals, it should only apply to male animals. And so again, it gets into the question of how closely are we matching the original story. But l'halach l'maisa, that distinction is very difficult. And there's a whole history behind this, that the Crazy Uplacy writes, or seems to write, that he's got a good proof that that position is not true, that it applies both to male animals and to female animals. How do you know? Because if you look in the Smag, if you look in the Sefer Mitzvahs Gadol, so he says that the Yitzir Get Hanasha applies to Zucharim and Nekevos. So the later Svarim point out, what are you talking about? That doesn't seem to be the correct reading. That if you ever learn the Sefer Achinuch, for example, when he talks about any mitzvah, so he goes through who it applies to and who it doesn't apply to. And he'll often say the mitzvah applies to Zecharim and Nekevos. And so what does he mean when he says that? What he means is that male and female human beings are obligated to follow this mitzvah. So that language wouldn't mean that female animals are also subject to a prohibition of Get Hanasha. It would mean that female human beings are also not allowed to eat the Get Hanasha. So it seems so strange that Ravona Sinaitris, even though the halacha is correct, but that he would bring a proof from that language, that's not what it means. Doesn't Ravona Sinaitris know that? So there's a whole history behind that in Gersology, as far as what the Girsa actually is. And more recently, in the past 100 years, there was a Rav in Los Angeles, Rav Neches, in the early 1900s, where he pointed out that he had a original manuscript of the Crazy Uplacy, and points out that it's referring to a different text, and that it's actually referring to, here there's also two theories. There was a theory that was referring to the Bahag, and the manuscript is pointed out, it's actually talking about a text called the Sefer HaNikur, which is about the dealing with the Get Hanasha. And there it's clear it's talking about male animals and female animals. Okay, so we can save Ravona Sinaitris from the accusation of misreading. But the point being that the Havamina of this view that he rejects is that maybe we should be so closely connected to the original story that we should only have the prohibition when it comes to male animals and not to female animals. And all the points that we saw in the Mishnah, where the Mishnah says it applies to Chayei and Oaf and not to Chayei Behema and not to an Oaf, and it doesn't apply to, it applies to a shlil, it applies to an unborn baby, etc., and it applies on both the right side and the left side. So we see that Rav Yehuda disagrees with all of these statements in the Mishnah, some of them in the Mishnah, and some of them in citations later on in the Gemara. So what seems to be the pattern of his disagreement is this issue. Basically, how closely do we stick to the original story? So should we say, okay, the original story, it was only on one side of the body, and it wasn't on a shlil, it wasn't on a fetus, and therefore we should be limited very directly to that. And the Chachamim see it, no, as a broader prohibition that applies beyond the parameters of the original story. And recall, as you mentioned yesterday, the whole question of whether it applies to non-kosher animals was tied into that story. That Rabbi Yehuda said it should apply to non-kosher animals also, because if we go back to the time of Yaakov, so by then there were no distinctions between kosher animals and non-kosher animals. So that should be the same status as here. And then the Gemara says that no, the mitzvah was actually from Har Sinai. So at Har Sinai, the Isser was redefined, and there we do have a concept of kosher animals and non-kosher animals, so it only applies to kosher animals. Okay, so far so good? Never hold me? Okay, so it's interesting also that the Rambam, if you throw the Rambams on the list, the Rambam seems to not follow the flow of the Gemara. Because, just to review the flow of the Gemara in Pesachim, so the Gemara has a machlokus there about whether Gid Hanasha is Asr Bahana or Mutter Bahana. And the flow of the discussion was that Rabbi Vohu was of the opinion that a default Isr Hana is, default Isr Hana goes along with an Isr Achila. If the Torah says you're not allowed to eat something, so then you're not allowed to get Hana from it either. So the Gemara says, what about a Nevela? Nevela, we know you're allowed to get Hana from it. You can feed it to your dog or you can sell it to a non-Jew. So apparently there's no Isser Hana by a Nevela. So Gemara says that's spelled out in the Torah. The Torah, by telling you that, is making it the exception. So then the question was, okay, so what about Gid Hanasha? So is Gid Hanasha subject to an Isser Hana? So it's machlokes. If you say it's mutter v'hana, so then is that against Rav Aval? So the Gemara says maybe it was included in the Heter Nevela. So the Gemara says, well, that all depends. Because do you believe that the Gid Hanasha is food or not? Is it regular food or is it regular basar? As we saw, there's possibly a distinction that maybe it's called food, but it's not called basar. Or maybe it's not food bichlal, two different ways of seeing it. So if it's not considered to be a normal part of the meat, so then maybe it shouldn't be included in the Heter Nevela. It's not a part of that whole category. So that was also what Dov Machlokis, do we say Ein Begidin Beno Saint Tam? Do we say that Gidin do not confer taste to other parts because it's not normal food or not? So the flow of the Gemara should be that if Yesh begin in Beno Saint Tam, then it's Mutter Bahana because it's included in the Heter of Nevela. But if Ain begin in Beno Saint Tam, then it's not included in the Nevela category, and then it's Asur Bahana. Everyone follow that? A little tricky calculation. So the Rambam, as is often the case, the Rambam seems to paskin on his own schedule. He seems to not stick to that clear, because the Rambam paskins that a Gid Hanasha is mutter b'hana, but also they ain't begin b'no Saint Tam. So it doesn't follow the path of the Gemara, where the Gemara seems to say that you could only say it's mutter b'hana if it was included in the Vela, which means you'd have to say that it's normal food, that it's normal basur. So there's a lot of analysis to that Rambam. That's, in general, not so unusual for the Rambam to have his own approach to something which doesn't necessarily follow how the Gemara assigns the positions. It sometimes comes in with a different svar. When I was in Karaviavna, the Rosh Yeshiva was the original Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Yaakov Goldsmith. This was often something he would talk about in his Shir Kalis. We would talk about explaining why the Rambam took a different path in how the Gemara associates the positions. So here, he leaves room to wonder that maybe he must be coming at it for a different reason. That he must say that Ein Begidin B'no Saint Tam, and yet it's its own calculation as to how it gets acknowledged in order to be subject to the removal of the Isser Hana. So in general, there is a challenge with the position of Ein Begidin B'no Saint Tam. Because if you say, and that seems to be this dominant position, that it doesn't have its own Isser, So it doesn't have its own status to have its own ist, doesn't have its own taste. It's not normal food. And in fact, the Gemara has a line that Eitzu, the Hatorah is Rasa. Eitzu is basically wood. It's not normal food. It's not normal meat. So there's a problem with that, because to have an Isra Achila is going to be incompatible with that. To say that it's not food and it's basically tasteless. So we have a rule that in order to be liable for something, that if you eat something that's not real food, not roi l'achila in a sense, so normally you're pater. So how could it be that there's a chiyuv for eating the git hanasha if that's indeed the case, that it's tasteless? You hear the question? If normally, if you were to have any other food in a way that's not something people would eat, so we'd say that's not kederach achila. It's not kederach hanasa. So when it comes to git hanasha, so how could you ever be chayav? So this is a big discussion in the Achronim. And for example, Rav Asher Weiss, in his Sefer on Chumash, was recently updated. So he goes through this issue, and he considers the question of, when it comes to git hanasha, is it possible to take some other approach? So one approach, you could say, is that you're right, that by the default rules, you should not be chayav for eating a git hanasha. So for example, if, let's say you had an animal that wasn't shechted, it's a nevela, and there was no specific prohibition of eating the git hanasha. So if one were to eat the git hanasha of this animal, so should it be subject to the prohibition of nevela? So on the surface, by default, maybe you would say no. Or you would say it's not derech achila. This isn't something that people eat. But on the other hand, the fact that it's a prohibition in the Torah, so that might make a difference. And that goes from the concept of achshavei, that there is a notion that sometimes something may not have chashivas by itself, may not have importance, but there's something external which gives it importance. So that chashivas could come from something that we do, or it could come from something in the text. So if the Torah takes the time to say, don't eat the git hanasha, so then that gives it a status that it would not have otherwise had. That by default, maybe you could say, Eitzu, it's just wood, and therefore this is not derech achila. So if you had a nevela and you had a little piece of it that doesn't have any chashivas, you shouldn't be chayiv. But because the Torah goes out of its way to mention it, so that would have support. This concept of achshavei could sometimes come from the Torah itself. It could sometimes come from the way we relate to something. So this comes up in halacha, for example, that when it comes to Hilchos Pesach, so there's a whole discussion about medications and the like, let's say, that are made out of chametz, that are not roi l'achila. So there you find that if it's not something you'd normally eat, so you should be pater, because it's not derech achila. But we have a concept that when you give something chashivas, if you're paying attention to it enough to eat it, so then it should at least be an issur d'rabbanan, because you gave it status by your attention to it. And there Reb Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says, but even if that's true, so medications should be different, because medications people take, even if they're not interested in something. So it doesn't mean that the food is tasty to them or the food is significant to them. They're forced to do it by their medical need. So that would limit the application of achshavei. Or, for example, we have a concept of a chatishir. A chatishir, which we talked about a little bit earlier in the year, where normally you're only liable for something if you eat a kezias, let's say. So if you eat a kezias, so then you've had enough to be punishable, and less than that is not significant. But we have a prohibition still to eat any amount. We call chati shir. It's not subject to an onesh. The punishment only comes with a full shir. But as a prohibition, you're not allowed to have even a small amount. So there, some explain that that's a function of achshavei also. So for sure, on a level of the Rabbana, one wouldn't be able to have, let's say, a little Hershey Kiss made of pork, even though it's less than a kezias, because taking the trouble to eat it would be an expression of chashivas. So at least on an Issa Rabbanan, that should be significant. Happens to be that we paskin that it's actually more than that, it's an Isra Daraisa. And the Gemara in Yuma has some explanation of why that is, why should it be treated as an Isra Daraisa, but that may also be, as some understand, a function of there being chashivas that the Torah gives to it, because according to one opinion in the Gemara, there is a pasuk which indicates that by all prohibitions you shouldn't have even a small amount. So that would seem to say that, okay, you're paying attention to it, you're giving it chashivas, so that makes it significant. Now, parenthetically, we're talking about chati shir as applied to a gidhanasha. So the primogodim had a chiddush that since gidhanasha is unusual, that here it's basically an inedible item that is being prohibited anyway, it says, so we wouldn't actually have the Isser Chati Shir. Why? So he comes at it from a different direction. That another angle the Gemara has to the prohibition of Chati Shir is that even though you're only liable to, if you have a full kezias or something, you're only going to be Chayiv Malkus if you have a kezias of treifus, or kezias of chazer, or kezias of nevela, whatever it is, we should still prohibit having even less. One explanation in the Gemara is that kevan de chazil is trufe isura ka'achil, that since it's possible to combine it with more, that creates an isser. So some understand that means that we're afraid that you're just going to keep going, what you call the potato chip svar, that you can't have just one. So even if one is less than a kezias, but once you have a whole bag, you're going to keep eating. So if that's a concern in general, when it comes to prohibited foods, that even if it's okay to have a little bit, you're going to keep going. So you might say, well, okay, but what's the connection? If I had half a bite of pork now, and a few minutes later I have another half a bite of pork, so each one is less than a kezias. What connects A to B? So the answer is that when it comes to eating, there's a concept of kedei achilas pras, that if you eat two things in the time that it takes to eat a loaf of bread, so then that connects two separate actions. And therefore, you shouldn't say, well, I had half now and half then. There's nothing to do with each other. If they're in that time period, they all come to unite. So says the Prima Gaudim, that's a general Torah rule, that you can connect things for eating purposes, even if they're a few minutes away. But, he says, the Gidhanasha is not subject to general Torah rules, because the Gidhanasha is a Chiddush. it already defies Torah rules because it's an inedible thing that we're prohibited to eat. So already that's not following Torah rules, what we call a chiddush in halachic terms. So therefore, the ability to join two bites at separate times is not going to be there. So therefore, says the Prima Gaddin, the only way you could be liable for eating a Gid Hanasha is if you eat the whole thing at one time. If you break it up, then you're not going to be liable because there isn't any technique that's going to unite these two separate parts. So that's a chiddush when it comes to Gid Hanasha. He says, essentially, there's no prohibition of Chatzi Shir. And this isn't the direction it's coming from, but that also you could tie into the connection to Yaakov and say that it's all historical, and therefore it has to follow a certain very specific model, and as soon as you deviate from that, it's not going to have the same status. It's not going to be in the same category. Which also goes to the question we started with yesterday, that should we treat Gid Hanasha like normal non-kosher food? Or should we say that it has a Zikaron component to it, and therefore it is uniquely tied in to how it relates to the story, and doesn't have the same rules as normal non-kosher food? And therefore also has its own details, like it has to all be eaten in one shot in order to be liable. So in any event, so how could you be subject to a liability if it's something that you don't normally eat? So one way to say it is achshave, that the Torah gives it a special attention, and therefore it's subject to its own prohibition, uniquely against the rules. Or you could say that it's not so absolute. When you say ain't begin the no same time, that maybe you would say that it's not as strong of a time as the other parts of the animal. It can't really hold its own with normal meat. But there's some taste there. There's what we call a tam kolosh, a weak taste. So it doesn't mean that it's nothing. It just means that compared to other parts of the animal, it doesn't rank. But to say it's mamish na kedarach hafilo, maybe that's not the case. But that's a little difficult also, because the language of the Gemara of Eitzu, that it's just wood, sounds like it's mamish no taste, not like it's a weak taste. Now, this also calls into question, we said yesterday, we quoted the Rush, right, that the Rush said that the prohibition of eating Gid Hanasha is an onesh. Right, that because the family of Yaakov didn't take care of him, didn't protect him from getting into an attack, so therefore they lose out on the Gid Hanasha. And there, the Rosh says, they lost out on a Meichel Tov, right? We mentioned this yesterday, they lost out on some tasty morsel. So that seems to contradict this. So if it's tasty, then it seems like it's not just wood. So what might be the answer is, and might be the answer to both questions, is that perhaps when one would eat the Gid Hanasha, so one would have it with other parts of the meat, or would have it seasoned a certain way. You wouldn't have it by itself. That to eat the Gid Hanasha just by itself, without any kind of spicing or seasoning or any kind of preparation, that would be not kedarach hafilo. But you could have it in the context of other things, and that would be derech hafilo. And therefore, the prohibition, which is how it impacts us, is not that we can't eat this item, but it's that it has to be removed from the rest of the meat in order to allow us to eat any of the meat, even the part that's not the Gid Hanashi. So that's essentially how it comes up practically. Right? It has to be removed laboriously from the animal. And that ends up impacting us because, and here there are differences in Ashkenazi and Sephardi practice, because that may rule out other tasty parts of the animal because of the difficulty of removing the Gid Hanashi. And it's also interesting because if that's what essentially the emphasis is, right, that the emphasis is not to eat this part, but that you have to remove this part from the meat. So then maybe that also helps us, it becomes a little bit more of a positive action, even though it's a function of an iser. But our whole question of how can it be a zikaro, how can it be something that you are remembering anything from if it's just something you avoid? Well, if the focus of the mitzvah becomes, because you're not allowed to eat this, you have to laboriously remove it from the parts that you do want to eat, so then there's a little bit more room for it to be something that could be a zikaron of some kind. Now, again, for us, we're not butchers and we're not shoftim, so it doesn't end up having that role for us because we just never see the Gid Hanashi. But maybe in a chanani, but maybe technically the impact of the mitzvah is in the act of removing it. That could be. It's also interesting that the Rambam also attracts attention because the Rambam paskins that if you were to have the Gid Hanashi of a nevela, so then you'd be Chayav Malchus twice, for the nevela status and for the Gid Hanashi status, which is a interesting question. First of all, seems to contradict again the sources in the Gemara. So there, maybe the answer is again that Achshavei could come in, the fact that it has extra chashivas as its own Isser. And the question of Ein Isser Chalal Isser. So how do you have one Isser come and take place on top of an existing Isser? So there's all kinds of technicalities to that question. But I think we alluded to yesterday, it could also be that maybe the Isser of Gid Hanashi is different than other machalos asuras. Other machalos asuras are asur b'chefsa. The item is itself got something wrong with it. It wasn't shechted properly. It's from a behemoth tmeya, whatever it is. While Gid Hanashi is a unique kind of isur, as far as this is concerned. It's more of a isur gavra. It's an isur on the individual because it's how the individual is supposed to relate to the historical component. And maybe those two can coexist. You can have an Isser Nevela, which is on the animal, and the Isser Gid Hanashi, which is on the individual relating to the animal. Okay, so far so good. So maybe say one more point about the Hashgafa behind it, and then we'll just review. You said some complicated things. So we mentioned what the phrase Gid Hanashi means, that Rashi explains in Chumash and in Chulin that it means that it jumped, that it moved out of its place, that the nerve was dislocated. And that's what we remember. There are some who associate some philosophical and Kabbalistic significance to that. But there are other interpretations, and Rav Neventhal Shlita has a very interesting sicha in the Sefer on Chumash and Parshas Vayishlach, where he discusses another possible meaning of Gid Hanashi. And he understands that it comes from the language of forgetting. Like we find that one of Yosef's sons was named Menashe. And there, the Torah explains, Ki Nashani made me forget. That the language of Nashek could mean a attempt to make someone else forget, or an effort to make someone else forget. And that's a big thing, to be so weighed down so that you can't focus on what's important. So this normally comes up Parshas Vayishlach, so it's timely because of Hanukkah, and now we're closer to the 3 weeks, so we can make it timely as far as that's concerned also. But in the Hanukkah reference, you know, we say in Al Hanisim that the efforts of the Yevanim were lahashkicham Torah Secha, right? They tried to make us forget the Torah. They tried to overwhelm us with other forces, so we would not be able to remember the Torah. So now we're not holding by Hanukkah, we're holding by the 3 weeks coming up next. So there is a reference in that context also that, I think Rav Zevenfeld talks about this, that there was a whole discussion that when the whole story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa that the Gemara in Gittin relates, that the Churban happened because there was a whole fight between the within the Jews because of this guy who didn't get invited to a party, and he was so upset that he informed on the Jews and he got them in trouble with the Caesar. So the Gemara tells the story that this informer tried to get the Jews in trouble. He told the Caesar, send them an animal as a korban and you'll see they won't accept it. So they would have accepted it, but this guy had a scam, had a scheme going on, so he put a mum in the animal. He put a blemish in the animal so that the Jews wouldn't accept it because it has a mum. But he would think they weren't accepting it because of him. So the Gemara says there was a whole debate among the Chachamim that they wanted to bring the korban anyway, so they shouldn't get in trouble with the king. And Chai ibn of Kulas, so he said, no, that they'll say, Yomru bali mumin craven lagabim is bad. But people will think that you can bring an animal that has a mum. And then the Gemara says, after a little bit more back and forth, that because the Chai ibn of Kulas was so limited, however you want to check, the Gemara says, because of Anivus, so things went horribly wrong, and there was a disaster, and there was a Churban Beit HaMikdash. So where was he coming from? Okay, it's such a big Avera to bring an animal that has a mum. I mean, it was a takana situation. What was he so afraid of? So Rav Nevinsal suggests that what he was afraid of was that the halacha would be forgotten. And so the yomru, bali mum, and craven on his back, that people would just forget for the long term what the halacha was. And that's a greater danger than any one discrete aveir. So you might say, okay, but the Gemara says he was wrong. It was the wrong cheshbon. That's not such a big deal. So the answer is no. He's right, but it led to the churban. So you had to be able to see the big picture. So the churban is a far greater blow to being able to remember the Torah than any one detail. So his problem was not being able to see the whole story, that yes, he was right to be concerned that there shouldn't be a misimpression created long term about the halacha. But at the expense of all Torah being impacted because of the Churban, that was where the miscalculation was. So we're very aware of the need to be able to focus and to preserve the experience of the Torah and not to be overwhelmed and to forget about it. So here, the attack of the Saro Shalesa of Yaakov was in that spirit of Hashkicha and Torah Secha, as we say in the context of Hanukkah, that by creating such a distraction for the Jewish people, they're not able to focus on their Avodas Hashem. And our response to that is, no, we don't care about this. So you hit us in the Gid Hanasha, we don't care about the Gid Hanasha. So then that's not something we need, like we saw that approach yesterday. And that's not something, like the Sforno said, it's not something that we have to care about. We can see past it. And we're able to overcome the distraction. And I think that's something we can all relate to these past few months when the whole world has been in such crisis and been weighed down by so many life and death considerations. And yet we've persevered and continued to learn and continued to be involved in Torah throughout. That's a victory against the Lashkicham Torah Secha, against that which would try to weigh us down so we can't remember the Torah. So the whole message of the Gid Hanash is set that aside, set aside the distraction, set aside what it is that's trying to keep us from having focus and involvement in learning, and we're able to keep that going. So maybe that also is a working theory as far as how all the parts of the prohibition come together, how it can be a zikaron, and how it can nonetheless play out the way it does. Okay, so let's just try to recap some of the key points. I know some of the things we said today were a little complicated, so please don't hesitate to ask, but just to recap the main points that we said today. So we talked about the relationship to the story of Yaakov and the whole history of whether there was a prohibition from the days of Yaakov or it's a mitzvah that only comes from Har Sinai and on. And the idea that if it's from Har Sinai and on, specifically like the Gemara sounds like and like the Rambam says, so the fact that it's taught in Vayishlach must have some special significance, as the Gemara also indicates. And we noted, therefore, a stronger than usual connection between the time of the mitzvah and the detail of the mitzvah. And we compared it to Sukkah, where the Bach says that the Torah emphasizes L'man Yedu Dorotechem, because remembering the reasoning is particularly important for the mitzvah. But here it's a little bit of a harder fit because it's more about what you don't do than what you do do. So the role of Kavana is harder to figure out, and we tried to keep that in mind a little bit. And we spoke about overall how the details of the din might be impacted by following more closely the story. So what did we talk about? We talked about the theory that it should only apply to male animals, not female animals. That's not true of halacha, according to anybody, really. But the Krasi quoted that view and rejected it. And we talked a little bit about the whole history of what he was using to support that rejection. But one way or another, it applies to male animals and to female animals, just as the issue of eating it applies to male people and to female people. And we talked about how the whole pattern of Rabbi Yehuda arguing on Chachamim also could reflect this question of how closely are we sticking to the story. And then we got also into the discussion of the Stira and the Rambam, that the Rambam doesn't seem to follow the Gemara's association on the question of Isser Hana and or Heter Hana, and the question of whether Yesh the Gid Benosin Tam or in the Gid Benosin Tam, does the Gid Hanasha have a status of food or a status of basur or somewhere in between? And that got us into the whole discussion of Achshavei, that sometimes something wouldn't be significant by nature, but the Torah or we, in our behavior, depending on what we're talking about, give it significance. And we got into the discussion of Chatzi Shir, how if something is less than a shir, it doesn't have significance, but by paying attention to it, then at least there's some prohibition because we gave it significance. And that the Chatzi Shir, it's interesting, Prima Gadim asserts doesn't even apply to Gid Hanasha for reasons of it being a Chiddush, for reasons that it doesn't follow Torah patterns in general, because it's basically not food and yet it's prohibited. So therefore it's already an outlier, already doesn't follow rules. And that's one interesting aspect. And then we talked about the question of if it is so tasteless, so how could it be prohibited at all? It's Shlo Kedarech Achila. And we mentioned a few approaches. One approach is Achshavei, that the Torah singling it out gives it status, or that maybe it's not really that it's tasteless, it has a weak taste. It just doesn't measure up to the rest of the animal. Or maybe no, maybe it is tasteless, but the chiyuv here, the liability, is if you have it together with other things that make it edible. And that's interesting also, because that means that really the nature of the Isser is not so much that you shouldn't eat the Gid Hanasha, it's that in order to eat anything around the Gid Hanasha, you have to remove the Gid Hanasha. And that allows us to see it more as something active, even though it manifests itself as a prohibition, and even though it's really only going to play out that way for people who are butchers or people who have to actively remove it. But nonetheless, maybe that's the case. Maybe that's the nature of the Isser. And we talked also about how the Rambam says that if you have a nevela and a Gid Hanasha, say you're chayiv twice, and that opens up the question of Achshavei also, and also the question of Ein Isser Chalal Isser. And we discussed how some suggest that the Isser of Gid Hanasha is on the Gavra, it's on how we relate to the item, and maybe that's a different track than an Isser in the item itself. And therefore, those two could coexist. The animal could be usher itself because it's an avela, and the individual could have an isser, Gid Hanasha, and how we relate to it. And then we discussed usher of Zevin Sal Sicha, where he understands Hanasha not as moving out of place, but as something that was forgotten, or something that makes us forget, and how that's a particular danger, the idea of us not just not observing the Torah, but forgetting the Torah because we're so overwhelmed by other things. And that was what the attack on Yaakov represents, that the Tsar Shel Esav was trying to distract him and overwhelm him. And survival is our statement that we persist despite this, and that we're not going to get overwhelmed and distracted and to forget the Torah. And that's something which is very resonant for us in our current crisis and our persevering through the learning nonetheless. Okay, so I hope that's all clear. I know some of that was a little complicated, so please don't hesitate to reach out and ask if you have any questions. And God willing, for tomorrow, we'll give you some new makaris and some new sources. We'll talk about the obligation, the positive mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, which itself has its own whole category and whole collection of implications for Kol Torah Kula also. And in a different way, bring the whole discussion of Tamei HaMitzvos into practice. Okay, so I wish you a wonderful day. You should stay safe and healthy, and I will see you, God willing, tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Kol Tov.
Thank you, Abby.
Thank you. Bye-bye.